This week on Potlatch, two field investigators for the State Human Rights Commission, Grace Cross of Gamble and Morgan Solomon from Wainwright. First, this report from the Department of Fish and Game by Dave Johnson.
This is game biologist Dave Johnson with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Fairbanks with a special report on the Western Arctic caribou. Certainly one of the most important decisions reached at the recent game board meeting in Fairbanks was the allocation of permits to a number of Northwest Alaska villages to take a total of 3,000 caribou in the Western Arctic. Some Alaskans have lobbied very hard for a total closure of the herd to all hunting. Others have lobbied with equal vigor to keep the herd open to relatively unrestricted hunting. The question that faced the board then was how to at least partially satisfy both sets of interests and still help the caribou herd to recover. Game Board Chairman Dr. Samuel Harbo admitted that as far as the Western Arctic herd was concerned, an absolutely zero take would have been the best choice. Nevertheless, the board felt it was also essential to consider the sustenance needs of the people in the area. He put it this way.
Some of the villagers in certain villages are very dependent on that herd for their protein source. Their overwhelming need for protein, I think, would have caused a complete closure to be, in effect, less than a complete closure. I think the emergency need clause would have come into play. I think it would have meant then a necessary emergency harvest of animals.
Furthermore, Dr. Harbo said, for any regulation to be effective, there needs to be some minimum level of acceptance of it. With those considerations in mind, he said, the board tried to structure the harvest in such a way that it would have a minimum impact on the caribou population, thus the decision to harvest 3,000 bulls. One of the stickiest issues that faced the board was how to allocate the 3,000 permits among the various villages. Again, Dr. Harbo.
Our first consideration, of course, was what level of harvest would be acceptable as far as the herd welfare was concerned. Then, and with the considerable help of many of the native leaders and representatives from northwestern Alaska, the apportionment to different villages was made partly on the basis of human population size in the village, but mainly on the basis of need in the village. Such criteria as, is there an alternative protein source available? How many individuals have employment in the village? Anything that essentially provided information on the ability of an individual or the village as a whole to provide a protein source other than caribou was taken into consideration in allocating the 3,000 individuals. Again, the input that we had from many of the villagers and from leaders in northwestern Alaska was critical in determining the allocation.
There were a number of proposals considered at the board meeting relating to minimizing the effects of caribou harvest on the herd. For example, the board considered and adopted regulations that make it illegal to take caribou on the same day airborne in the range of the Western Arctic caribou, to feed caribou meat to dogs, and to leave caribou meat on the tundra in the traditional manner of cold storage. The board, however, did retain the provision that allows caribou meat in that area to be bartered. Another subject of considerable importance discussed at the game board meeting was the matter of wolf control in that area. At its regular meeting last March, the Board of Game directed the Department of Fish and Game to control wolves if either the total herd size or the productivity was below a certain level. Unfortunately, as most of us are only too well aware, the herd is well below these levels. For this reason, the Department of Fish and Game is preparing to control wolves in the Western Arctic. The specific plans for controlling wolves have yet to be devised, but according to Game Division Director Robert Rausch, the wolves will be taken with the aid of aircraft through issuance of permits to department agents, and if necessary to achieve the desired level of control, department employees may be allowed to take some of the wolves. Although the number of wolves in the area is not known with great precision, the techniques the state has used in the past have proven to be quite accurate, Rausch said, and he said the present estimates are in the vicinity of 1,300 wolves, plus or minus, within the range of the western Arctic caribou. He said the size of the wolf population will be more accurately determined when there is snow on the ground, so census techniques may be used. The action taken by the board has very much reduced the take of caribou by men, so the logical question is, why can't we just leave it at that and not take any wolves? Rausch explains.
We're in one of these unfortunate situations where our calculations show that if we achieved a zero use by humans, which we have not proposed, the pressure by the existing wolf population on the caribou resource would cause it to continue to decrease, at least in the short term, that is, until the wolf population adjusts through either self-regulation or other catastrophe. In other words, the wolves are taking more than the annual increment at the present time.
Department biologists believe wolves alone are consuming at least twice, and possibly as much as four or five times, the annual recruitment of new animals to the Western Arctic herd. There were no easy solutions in the board's search to find ways to help the Western Arctic caribou herd to increase, and certainly the decisions that were reached will not satisfy all Alaskans. However, most board members and many of those attending the board meeting appeared to feel that a workable compromise had been forged, and that given time, the Western Arctic caribou herd can potentially increase. With a special report on the Western Arctic caribou, this has been game biologist Dave Johnson in Fairbanks reporting.
Jeff Kennedy talking to field representatives for the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights. Morgan Solomon, originally from Wainwright, and Grace Cross, originally from Gamble. Mm-hmm. Morgan, how did you get involved in the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights?
Well, I just didn't get involved in this. I had taken my family up to Barrow for the circus and got interviewed by Neil Thomas, who is the director of the Human Rights Commission for State of Alaska. There was two others that were interviewed with me, and due to the fact that probably I was the only native-speaking Eskimo that was privileged this job.
And Grace, how did you get involved with the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights?
I applied for the job and I got it.
What are some of the problems that you're running into and some of the cases that you're representing or some of the cases that you're investigating?
I'm mostly involved in race discrimination. Most of the cases are somebody didn't get hired for a job because of their race, or they applied for housing and they didn't get the housing simply because they were Alaska Native or Black, or there are times that because they are a woman.
What do they say when they turn down a person who was an Alaska Native?
Usually in housing cases, the Alaska Native or a minority person would call up an ad in the paper, and they'd be told their apartment is available. So they go in person to look at it, and right away, you know, the manager or the owner would say, "I'm sorry, it's full, you know. Somebody already, we already have somebody that's going to rent for the place." And in that case, you know, we get a phone call from the person saying, "I think I'm discriminated against," or say, I'm being discriminated against because the apartment was available one time and all of a sudden it's not when I went in person. And I guess it's because this person saw that I was a minority.
Aren't people usually able to recognize over the phone whether somebody is an Alaska Native or not in many cases?
Not always.
How do you go about trying to prove that somebody's been discriminated against?
Well, there are times that we do send somebody over that's a non-minority to see if the apartment is still available. But a lot of times we make the initial phone call to the person, you know, the owner, and we talk to them and see what's happening. You know, is the apartment in fact vacant? What happened in that case, you know? Who did they eventually rent it to?
Well, have you run into any problems on discrimination and hiring on, say, the pipeline?
Yes. Most of our complaints, I think, come from women. You know, a lot of women are just going to crafts of, you know, traditionally men crafts, you know, male crafts. And most men don't want a woman around simply because she's a woman, she's not strong enough, or they come up with some reason, you know.
Are there any complaints you get from Alaska Natives who are not hired, Alaska Native men?
Yes. I think most of it is because, you know, most of the jobs in the pipeline are union-related, and most in rural Alaska there are no unions, and Alaska Natives do not join unions simply because they do not know they exist or not aware of them.
Or they, maybe they can they afford, in very many instances, can they afford the union dues?
In a lot of instances, no.
What do you do in that case if you run into somebody who says, "We don't discriminate against an Alaska Native, it's just that we don't hire anybody who isn't a union member"? What do you do in that case?
See, there's a lot of things that we check into. In discrimination cases, we check into their employment record to see how many Alaska Natives they have or to see how many women the company has and what reasons they turn down people for jobs. And to see how many, for instance, in a non-union case, we check in to see how many men that they have hired or how many whites that they have hired that are non-union. And they eventually put them in the union program.
I see. So there are instances where people do get hired who are not members of the unions.
Yes.
And then you check and see. Do you get any non-natives, do you get any whites who say that they are not hired in the pipeline because they're not native or because they're not black?
Yes, we get a lot of that too. We investigate those cases. This is what we call reverse discrimination. They're so much harder to work with than for minorities and for women cases. But we do have cases where we have, we found that a white male is not hired simply because he's a white male.
Is there anybody who says that he doesn't hire Alaskan Natives because he doesn't think that he thinks that they'll just go out and get drunk? You get any of that kind of statements?
Not that blunt, no.
It's usually
they're very subtle about it. You know, that's really kind of I think what you call really discreet kind of discrimination. You know, they'll find some reason to fire an Alaska Native. You know, it may be reduction in force, and all the persons that they lay off may be all minorities. Or they go in a seniority system, and the last persons to be hired happen to be Alaska Natives or Mexicans, so they lay them off.
Does your agency fight that sort of thing or go along with it, the seniority system?
It depends on how it's, you know, how the agencies use it. For instance, if they lay off the last persons that are, you know, the last persons hired, there's several whites and there's several natives and there's several blacks, and they're last hired, and that's just the way that they do it, you know. They're not using a discriminatory.
She went away, and now she's gone, and I don't worry. Lord, I'm sitting on top of the world. She called me up from down in El Paso. She said, come back, Daddy, who needs you so? And now she's gone, and I don't worry. Lord, I'm sitting on top of the world. If you don't like my peaches, don't you shake my tree and get out of my orchard, let my peaches be. And now she's gone, and I don't worry. Lord, I'm sitting on top of the world. And don't you come here running, holding out your hand. I'm gonna get me a woman like you got your man. Now she's gone, and I don't worry. Lord, I'm sitting on top of the world. Was in the spring, one sunny day, my sweetheart left me. Lord, she went away, and now she's gone, and I don't worry. Lord, I'm sitting on top of.
Doc Watson. Speaking of on top of the world, Morgan Solomon, you'll be opening an office of the State Human Rights Commission in Barrow. What problems do you anticipate there?
For the whole North Slope area, I believe the biggest project that I'll probably have will be housing discrimination up there. This big problem area that I'll be covering is due to the HUD program that we have presently going. And in doing so, I think probably the financial background behind this program is pretty high for natives to affiliate. In other words, there are some housing programs that went all the way up as far as $58,000 per home, and these are supposed to be low-income housing. And in this respect, there are peoples up there, my native people, just can't afford this type of money, and they don't make that type of money up there. This is probably the biggest project that I'll have as far as discrimination, I would say, as far as the housing projects are concerned.
You mean the houses are being, the HUD programs are for building $58,000 houses, and then the houses which your native people can't afford to live in. Is that what you're saying?
That's true, very true.
Oh, so this is a problem of the state agency running into what it considers discrimination by a federal agency.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How is the state agency going to take on a federal agency?
Well, we could probably work some programs to see what steps can be taken to eliminate discrimination as far as these houses are concerned, due to the fact that the poor natives there have the privilege of buying a home. But first and foremost, the ASHA always states that if you're going to buy a house got to have a land in it. So when they do, before they sell this home, what they do is they'll go ahead and put your land under unrestricted deed. So therefore, if the native can't make payments on this house that he bought from the HUD program or the ASHA program or any other, even the borough program, these agency has the right to go ahead and take the land away from them. This is some of the problem areas that we'll be looking into, I believe.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning, I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out a warning, I'd hammer out love between all of my brothers, all over this land.
If I had a bell, I'd ring it in the morning, I'd ring it in the evening.
Weavers. Morgan Solomon, what have been your personal experiences with discrimination in the past and in the present?
I was born in Wainwright, but I was raised in Fairbanks, and I see discriminations ever since I was moved here to the city of Fairbanks among with the natives. You don't see this too awful much up here in the city of Fairbanks, Anchorage, or any big cities within the state of Alaska due to the fact now that the natives are being recognized as being natives of Alaska. They were born here, they were raised here, and I believe that eventually this discrimination will linger away due to the fact that we're being recognized as corporations and organizations in this nature.
Sometimes I get the impression a lot of people resent Alaskan natives because of the land claim settlement. They think they're getting something for nothing.
Well, the people that say these things are usually people that have been up here a very short time. They don't know the culture of the natives. They've been around and about, but they don't know anything about the native culture. That's the biggest reason, probably.
Thank you.
Rise Up, Helicopter Like a Bird, that song from the village where Grace Cross was born, Gamble. Grace, what's been your personal experience with discrimination?
Most of the discrimination, I think, is very, very discreet, like I said. For instance, when we were looking for an apartment to rent, my husband he was unemployed at the time and I was going to school, so he was doing most of the looking for an apartment, you know. So he went to this one to see one of the apartments, and the guy said, okay, they'll be more than willing to rent it to him, you know, and told him he had two kids and a wife, and he said we would rent it, and that evening we went to, you know, he went to introduce the family to him, and then the guy said, no, I'm sorry, you know, I already rented to another place, another person. There are some longtime Alaskans, I don't know what type of experience they have with Alaska Natives, that don't want Alaska Natives there in their residential homes or don't want them moving around their area. And there are also, newcomers, like Morgan said, are not familiar with Alaska Natives, and they hear all the stereotypes from the old Alaskans that lived there. Like, for instance, Alaska Natives are drunks and, you know, all of the little stereotypes that they have. And they come up with a negative attitude towards Alaska Natives.
From other people.
From other people. Mostly, I guess, from people that already resided there. Or they end up in, when they come up from Lower 48, they don't have that much money. They end up in lower type of housing area. And they meet a different kind of Alaska Native, which fits somebody else's stereotype that they heard. Well, one expectation I could say not from, you know, if people from that move from Lower 48 to Alaska would be the Alaska Natives are rich. Oh, the Alaska Natives get a lot of children. How come they don't use birth control methods? They're forever getting kids, and Alaska Natives are awfully quiet.
Well, is that true? Are Alaska Eskimo people generally quiet?
There's quiet people from all races.
I don't think that we should go ahead and say that Alaska Natives are real quiet type people. It depends on who you meet out in the street, in the city. Let me tell you something about a quiet person. Okay. Like myself, I was born in Wainwright. But then when I went to Fairbanks, I couldn't speak English. So therefore, I was very quiet for the first few months, until the teacher started taking me into the English speaking type person. And then once after they got me started, I haven't stopped. But yet I speak my language as well. But I don't think there's quiet type people. It would take a long time. An Eskimo or a native Alaskan, regardless the race minority, will look into a situation before he gets into it. And we're not too awful quiet once after we feel that we fit into the community.
I think basically most Alaska Natives, I'm stereotyping right there, but for instance, me, I'm a pretty talkative person, but a lot of times I will listen before I say anything. I think it's because of the way I was raised. You know, you listen to people, and then you put your opinion in it. And your opinion better be very solid.
Our guests, Grace Cross of Gamble and Morgan Solomon from Wainwright. This is Jeff Kennedy. Thanks for listening. Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.